This is the CineSnob Podcast.
Hey, welcome to episode 293 of the CineSnob Podcast. I'm Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody Viafania.
Cody, it's once again draft lottery day.
Yes.
For the NBA. The Spurs had, two chances at, I don't know how it shook out. They didn't get the number one pick this year.
No.
But they got picks 4 and 8, and I don't really remember how they ended up with two picks in the lottery.
So basically they owned a protected pick from Toronto.
Okay.
From the Jakob Poeltl trade, where if it was top six, Toronto got to keep it, and then if it was below that, the Spurs got it. And Toronto had the sixth best odds, so yeah. That's how it shook out. The Spurs, the number four is their own pick, and then the eighth is Toronto's.
So who knows where that leaves everything, because there's no like clear, I don't think there's any like major, it's not a good draft class, as they say.
Well, it's
or not a strong draft class.
It's not that it's not strong. It's just that there's not a lot of like separation between the talent. So like there's not a consensus number one guy you have to get like there was last year, but there are some quality players out there. It's just sort of like they're not exactly like tiered in that way.
Yeah, well, it's not near as exciting as last year, but there is Victor Wembanyama's Rookie of the Year celebration this past week. So, Did you, I think we talked about it a little bit, but did you see, I guess it was a Dick's Sporting Goods on the south side of San Antonio, like released the t-shirts early?
No, I didn't see that.
That, they had them in, I guess, in stock, ready for them to go. And they just put them out on the shelf, at some point. I think it was like Saturday or Sunday before the announcement. Mm-hmm. And there was, people walking around San Antonio with Rookie of the Year shirts that were legit, but put out too early.
Hmm. Interesting.
I don't know. I mean, everything is merched to death now. I'm just not. I got bitten years and years ago when the Spurs would win like the Midwest Division champion, or win the Midwest Division. So you'd buy like a Midwest Division championship shirt, like back to back, and just nothing would happen with it. So you have this shirt that means nothing. And
yeah, I made a rule for myself that I don't ever buy any merch that's not championship merch for like accomplishments, because there's people out there who will buy like division champs or conference champs. Like nothing is worse to me than like winning the conference and then losing in the finals and having a conference champ shirt that means nothing.
Look, I'm guilty of that 100% because I get excited every single time and I get swept up in it.
Yeah.
And because they produce those conference championship like hats and other stuff, it's exciting. And I don't know the last time I ever wore a conference championship hat. I think my grandfather kept one in rotation for an awful long time because it was like he liked the way it looked. Like it was a white hat.
Yeah. No, there's some cool designs. I mean, like. Yeah, you know, there's been years where like the Astros have made it to the World Series and lost, and you know, there's great World Series merch, but I would never buy it unless they win. I don't want to be reminded of when they fell short.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not a big fan as much anymore of the championship hats that just replace the patch each time.
Yeah,
I don't like it. I liked when each one had its own unique design, or at least the appearance of unique design, since everything was embroidered. I've got like 5 championship hats hanging up over there, and I think at least the first 4 are pretty customized.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've had a couple weeks off, so I think it's probably about time to get into reviews. What do you say?
Let's do it. We're behind already.
All right.
Here are this week's reviews.
Next up, we have Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
What did I miss?
She spoke. She called my name.
You misheard.
You said this Nova was smarter than most.
Within reason. Some intelligence, to be sure.
I have a name. Meg. I know where they're taking your clan.
Here we are in the fourth movie in this rebooted Planet of the Apes series. Mm-hmm. I guess not necessarily rebooted, but a prequel series that started way back in, I think, 2010 or 2011 with Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which I wasn't a huge fan of. Mm-hmm. But then Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And then War for the Planet of the Apes, which I liked a lot. Those last two films directed by Matt Reeves. That are prequels to the 60s and 70s series, which I actually haven't really seen much of. I don't know about you, but this is continuing on with that series, that prequel series, many generations later. Tell us about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, Cody, and what you thought of it.
Yeah, so to be specific, I was reading over like the Wikipedia for the movie, and this movie apparently takes place 300 years after. After the last movie, which I think is actually kind of a cool move, right? I mean, I think, you know, you had this, you know, you had these three movies that kind of set everything up, and then this is meant to sort of like deviate or separate from that trilogy and start its own trilogy. I think I did read that they want to try to maybe do like 9 movies as part of this whole thing. I think it is kind of like a, I mean, it would have been very easy to like continue the journey of Caesar, I think, in some ways, but they make that clean break and they actually set it, you know, well into the future. I do have, you know, maybe like a couple of, not like complaints, but nitpicks about the setting of it all. But I think overall, I think it works. But yeah, it follows like the main kind of character in here is an ape named Noah. And he is sort of like he's in like a nomadic tribe of apes that are kind of like kind of self-sustaining, and I guess like his father is like the leader of the tribe, and what ends up happening is that their tribe ends up getting sort of captured by a tyrannical other ape and taken away, and he kind of goes on a journey to rescue them, and during this time, runs into a human character, kind of like the first human that he's really interacting with, and they sort of develop a bond and start to, figure out what each of them is kind of looking for, and then kind of build things from there. So, I think first off, it should be said, again, how great these movies look. It's the Weta technology, and I think, you know, they've sort of been on the forefront of this stuff for a long time, but, you know, between this and Avatar, you know, you have these movies where you're spending time almost exclusively with CG characters, and mm-hmm. you can have this, like, extremely compelling story carried by mocap performances, and I think that I don't think that it touches the level that like Andy Serkis was able to do in the Matt Reeves movies, where there was like a legitimate argument that maybe he should be nominated for an Oscar for his mocap performances in those movies. I don't think it hits the heights there in terms of like getting like a real emotional performance, but I do think that everyone in these roles is really good, and I think the movie looks amazing. I mean, again, it is exceedingly hard to do. Like, look at a Transformers movie, you know, like it's exceedingly hard to like make a compelling, like almost purely CG, world, and they really accomplish it here just with, how immersive it is. Now, to be fair, like, it's not like fully CG like Avatar, but it does look really great. Story wise, I actually think that the movie is pretty compelling narratively. Like I said, I really like the decision to set it so far into the future to allow for like a relaunch of this franchise. Like it feels like a soft reboot almost, where it's like it takes elements of that original trilogy and uses it, but in a way that kind of sets its own story into motion, where now what you're finding, like whereas like this was the first three was how the virus started, and then the slow takeover of the evolution of the apes, and then sort of them taking over and everything, this you're getting a future where apes are the dominant species, and humans are sort of relegated to, being in the minority. They've lost their speech for the most part. And again, like, kind of flipping it into, I guess, like, it's weird how they're kind of reconfiguring what I've understood to be Planet of the Apes originally, and kind of building towards what I guess was the main story of the originals, right?
What do you mean?
Well, because in the originals, they're already at like a total Planet of the Apes, right? It doesn't like turn into that. Like that's...
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, famously, the premise is that these astronauts land on this planet and they think they've gone somewhere else. And
right. But it's Earth.
It's Earth. Yeah.
So I do like that, we're getting sort of like the full spectrum of like, it feels like a full like epic story of everything. It also allows for some themes to show through. One theme that I think is really great, and I actually think that they don't do enough of, is this sort of idea that Caesar, like the movie starts off with showing that Caesar has died, and it's literally the first scene of the movie, so no spoilers.
Well, that's how war ended, right? I mean,
well,
I'm not crazy.
It ended with him wounded. But
no, I swear he fell over and died.
Oh, didn't? I thought he was wounded.
I was under the impression. It's been a long time since I've seen War. I haven't kept up with it. But my understanding was always that he was very clearly dead.
Okay. Then.
But whatever.
In that case, they show him like on a pyre or whatever.
Yeah.
In this one, so the interesting part about it is that. This other kind of clan of apes that is sort of starting a new modern, civilization, a kingdom, right? The leader who's played by Kevin Durant, I can't remember the name of that.
Proximus Caesar.
Caesar.
Yeah.
Is sort of twisting the words in many ways of Caesar in sort of like developing this kingdom using Caesar's words, but not his intent. And I think that is like a really interesting storyline about how, across the generations, his intent gets, completely shifted and manipulated by people looking to take power. I think there's a lot of like really juicy potential stuff there that I don't know that the movie is necessarily entirely interested in exploring. Which is kind of a bummer because I think it's a really interesting plot.
Yeah, I have thoughts on that, but go ahead.
Yeah. And essentially what you get in this movie, which I do think starts a little bit slow in my opinion, but kind of like the mid to last act ends up sort of turning into a bit of like a heist kind of, movie where they start, several of the characters start putting together a plan and look to execute it. It's like a multi-layered idea and plan. And then, you have a little bit of uncertainty on, can these people, or can the apes trust this human that for generations has been sort of, not only cast out, but seen as like, a threat. And so, I think it's an entertaining kind of final act as part of it. You do get those pieces of like the apes sort of talking about humans as if they're sort of like a primitive species and the sort of script gets flipped. And that piece of it is like semi-generic, but I also think, like an interesting bit of world building that it does. So yeah. And it does suffer a little bit from feeling like it is the first chapter of a full, a bigger story. But as far as like the nature of like starting this up again, and especially coming off of two movies that I feel were really highly regarded from a director that's really highly regarded, this movie's made by Wes Ball, who, quite honestly, his only credits to this point are. Shockingly, three Maze Runner movies. It's hard to believe that there were three of those, but those are his only movies he's directed. I think he is doing the Legend of Zelda live-action movie as his next project he has lined up. But it's a tough spot to be in to kind of take the reins of this franchise after a lot of really big success. And I do think that he's able to do it with a movie that does, at the very least, stand up to the others.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned a little bit before that I wasn't the biggest fan of Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I felt it was a little cornball. That's the one with James Franco and I think John Lithgow and Tom Felton is like a sadistic guy in the. It felt a little too cliche, I think was my major problem with it, and it felt a little. Is it David Oyelowo who's in that movie as well?
I'll look it up right now.
I thought he was like the bad, like one of the villains too. Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else, but
It was looking. Yes, David Oyelowo.
Yeah,
was
yeah,
there.
Okay, yeah.
Tom Felton,
Frida Pinto,
yeah. Brian Cox.
Yeah. Anyway, so I didn't love that movie, but man, by the time Dawn came around. And I think that was my first exposure to Matt Reeves. I still have not seen Let Me In, which I believe was his first. He didn't direct Cloverfield, did he?
He did, yes.
Okay, so yeah, it was Cloverfield, and I thought Cloverfield was fine. But and Dawn blew me away. Like, I loved that movie so much. War, I was a big fan of too. I don't think it quite stands up to Dawn, but I think that prison break sequence in it, and with the music, the Michael Giacchino score.
Yeah.
It's such great filmmaking. You know, by the time I heard about this one coming out, I was not as interested, just because it felt like, you know, they weren't rebooting it, but it was, like you said, a soft reboot. That said, I really enjoyed, I think you found the first half or first part a little slow, first act a little slow. I liked the world building of it. The problem is I don't know, and this is a huge problem I have with this movie and a lot of movies like it. I don't know that it really stands alone as a movie as much as it feels like the pilot episode of a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
I got that same issue most recently with the last Ninja Turtles movie, which I enjoyed enough, but it feels like it's just setting the stage for something else. And I don't mean that in the Marvel way where you get these like you're continuing from one story to move to the next story. Like, I feel like this starts its own brand new story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it mentions Caesar, which I did look up. He did die at the end of war. But you know, he's a messianic figure in this story, for lack of a better word. So, you know, it makes sense to start with him. It makes sense to have the teachings disrupted. I just feel like it just touches on enough stuff. Like, once that first act gets done, I think it kind of crams a lot in, and it doesn't really have a solid resolution for anything. Like, look, for example, and I won't say which characters, but there's two characters that have deaths off screen, which we're all smart enough to know that doesn't mean what it means, right?
Right.
Like, nobody has any illusions that these characters aren't returning. And I think that's a huge problem, because I think, you know, it's weird to say that a movie with a bunch of talking apes had stakes, but Dawn and War definitely had stakes.
Right.
Rise, you know, not so much, I didn't think, but this movie doesn't feel like it has any stakes because you know that there's something coming after it because of the way this movie is structured and the way it leaves it behind. You know, I feel like the ending is a little small, for what it's trying to accomplish. And it has a twist, I guess you would call it, that I don't know really makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, if this is indeed supposed to be 300 years later, which I have my doubts, I don't know. Where did you see that on Wikipedia?
It was a quote from Wes Ball.
Oh, Wes Ball. Oh, wow. Yeah. So that makes even a little bit less sense now. For that, whatever that twist ending is. That said, I do think it's good. I think it's probably, you know, my third favorite of these rebooted trilogy or rebooted films. So,
yeah.
You know, which is puts it ahead of Rise, essentially. You know, I'm eager to see what's next because I think, I mean, this technology is amazing. I mean, these are, as far as I'm concerned, they're real apes. You know, you're not looking at a special effect on the screen. It's so good.
Yeah.
You know, this one is obviously involving humans at a bigger level than anything in since Rise. So, you know, there's a big storyline that's cooking there that, you know, like I said, this movie leaves off on a, not, I wouldn't say a cliffhanger, but well, like there's definitely the idea that there's another chapter.
Well, I will say that this, I think I do agree with you that the sort of, the one of the characters is chasing an item in the movie, mm-hmm. and I do feel like the item ends up being underwhelming.
Agreed.
In sort of like, and also too, I think it's like maybe one of the, like, what that ultimately leads to and teases is like a less interesting idea, I think. I mean, I think it does. And you know what's interesting too about this series, and I'm curious to see how they do it here, is that to my knowledge, there's no, in the first three movies, there's no human characters or actors that repeat in those movies, right? It's a fresh cast every single time, which again is a super interesting way to treat a franchise. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to see if they do it here. I mean, do they keep around it's the, you know, the main human character here and build this into something different, or, you know, there's like these time gaps and there's new characters that happen in the first trilogy. I'd love to see them continue to do that, because I think that's a really fascinating way of like of building a franchise out.
Yeah, I would guess, just judging by how this movie ended, I would guess that they're going to keep it the same human, mm-hmm. at least one cast member. That said, I do feel like that's a sense of regression. I feel like it regresses some to me, mm-hmm. because that's what, like, you know, the you're charting the course of the war of sorry, from Rise to War is kind of the downfall of humanity. Because at the end, like the virus, like that's what happens to Woody Harrelson's character in War. He ends up like succumbing to that virus that makes him dumb and mm-hmm. can't talk and everything. Here we're kind of, I feel like it's setting up another ape human conflict for whatever the third movie in this trilogy ends up being. So mm-hmm. I'm not terribly thrilled about that. But I mean, I guess that is the era that we're living in, as this franchise, keep the franchise going for as long as possible. You know, I think Noah is a pretty good character. I don't think he's near as compelling as a Caesar. His motivation seems a little weird. Like he's kind of this peaceful, you know, non-guy, and he turns into this warrior ape mm-hmm. in the second act. So I don't know. I liked it. I mean, coming off the high of especially Dawn and War, it's a little bit of a, it's like a, not that I'm saying those movies are perfect movies, but it feels like a little bit of a Toy Story 4 situation. Mm. Like we're like, why are we doing this again? Like, oh, it gets fun to spend time with these things, but it, yeah. you know, it's a jury's out on whether or not it's going to be worth it in the end for me.
Right.
Anyway, what's your grade for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, Cody?
Well, I'm still going to give it a B. I think that for me, it's, you know, if you're going to reopen a sort of like trilogy here and start this thing back up again to mine the IP, I think this is a good way to do it, which is that you're not doing a total reboot and starting from scratch. You're respecting, I think, the look and the feel of the trilogy before it by also setting yourself apart. And I agree with you. I slot it as the third best. I think it's less than the first, it's less than the Reeves movies, but I do think that it is for sure better than the first, Dawn movie. So, I give it a B.
Yeah. Rise, Dawn, War, Kingdom. Dawn should really come before Rise, but
right. This was litigated.
Yeah. Anyway, B for me too. I talk a lot about the kind of potential disappointment. When it comes to the actual movie, I enjoyed it for the most part. I think it's pretty long. It's like just shy of 2.5 hours, and I think it shows a little bit, and then it kind of sputters near the end. But yeah, I enjoyed it, and I, you know, if they can all be of this caliber moving forward, I'll be okay with it, because mm-hmm. they're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to our next movie, The Fall Guy.
Why are you here?
I think there's been a misunderstanding.
Clearly.
Because I was under the impression that You did want me here.
That's a delusional thought. We haven't spoken in a year.
I'm happy for you. This whole director thing looks good on you. Even the gardening hat, somehow.
Everyone wears them. It's like a set thing. Okay?
Yeah, I see it. It's they're not making you look as good as you are. So. And I'm not trying to be flat. I'm just saying the facts. But you look good in everything. You look good in nothing, whatever. No, I don't mean
really?
It like that. But
this
you do look good in nothing.
This isn't going to work.
You do, but it's not what I...
So we missed this last week, but this premiered at South by Southwest. You didn't see the premiere there, right?
I did not, no.
Okay, but yeah, this is a, if you don't know, it's an adaptation of a TV series from the 80s. Starred Lee Majors as a stuntman who solves crimes. You know, that's what everything was in the 80s. It was somebody who X who solves crimes. So
yeah,
not that it matters because it has nothing really to do with it. But tell us about the Fall Guy, Cody, and what you thought of it.
Sure. So the movie is, the movie is starring obviously Ryan Gosling playing a stuntman for movies. And essentially, gets in an accident early on in the movie, and is sidelined for a while. They show him being sort of in a kind of relationship with Emily Blunt. Is originally a director of photography. Is that it?
Camera operator. I don't know if she's a cinematographer, but she's at least a camera operator.
Yeah, and then eventually it cuts to the future where Emily Blunt's character is making her first movie. After his injury, Ryan Gosling's character sort of, kind of isolated himself and is asked to go back to help her complete the movie, which ends up being sort of like a double duty here for him, because the real reason why he's called in is because he's a stunt double for this actor played by Aaron Taylor Johnson. This actor has gone missing on the set of this new movie, and he is enlisted to try to help track him down while also helping the film get finished. So, essentially what this movie ends up being is sort of like a love letter to stunt performers, in that, its main, character is a stunt performer. It features stunts of all kinds. You have your hand-to-hand combat, you have your gun stuff, you have dog stuff, you have car chases, explosions, anything that you can think of is kind of displayed here as part of the spectacle. And I think, for me personally, the movie sort of, there is so much heavy lifting done by Ryan Gosling's charisma, who I think, again, just continues to be, a really engaging performer. And I think can, there's this sort of like, there's the interesting thing with Gosling, because I think a lot of people really like him in Drive and where he's sort of like this very quiet, kind of calm character. But I think the gear that Gosling has that is the most entertaining is sort of the nice guys Gosling, which is sort of like he's such a legitimately funny actor that seeing him go like be able to be funny and entertaining and charismatic, I think is like he's like quintessential leading man chops. Yeah. And I think the movie really relies on his charisma to kind of get through it. I think Emily Blunt is good in it, and I think the relationship they have feels relatively authentic for the most part. But for me, this movie like gets really inundated with this story of him trying to track down Aaron Taylor Johnson's character. And for me, that story is like dead on arrival. For me, this story, I think, like sucks. I really, really don't like it. I think that it's really muddy and confusing early on, and then painfully obvious by the end of it. There's like a character that factors in where like there is no mystery that this character is like not what they're portraying to be. It's like one of the worst like examples of like, oh yeah, of course this is what's going on as part of it. But the problem I have with it, like stupidity aside, is that Gosling spends so much time on this, pun intended, wild goose chase, you know, trying to track down Aaron Taylor Johnson, that so much time is spent away from the movie set. And that stuff is the best stuff in the movie. The sort of behind the scenes stuff on the movie set, where you're getting to see the stunt stuff happen, you're getting to see the relationship between Gosling and Blunt, you know, the tension that's formed there, and you just, you're pulling Gosling away doing other stuff with, you know, like who is it, it's Brian Tyree Henry, right, who's
you're thinking of Bullet Train. He was in Bullet Train. Aaron Taylor Johnston.
I saw this movie like 3 weeks ago. Anyway,
and David Leitch directed that one too. So,
oh, that's right. Yeah. But anyway, you know, he's off with Winston Duke doing whatever. You know, he's, Aaron Taylor Johnston is doing like a Matthew McConaughey impression the whole movie, clearly. and again, that story is just such a nothing burger that ends up distracting from what I think are the elements of the movie that work better. I also feel like this movie has a really weird like pacing to it, where I feel like it's like and it's not necessarily a pacing of the movie itself, but like a pacing of the dialogue, where I feel like so there's this scene where like Emily Blunt is airing out her dirty laundry while directing a scene in the movie. And I feel that scene takes like an hour. that movie, that scene is so drawn out and long. And I feel like the humor of the movie doesn't really connect for me either. I don't think it's particularly funny. And I think that there's a few jokes that like completely whiff. And I feel like, again, it's like this, it's Gosling and Blunt trying as hard as they can to escape what I feel like is a pretty bad script. So for me, I think that it falls short on the shortcomings of its script, its dialogue, and getting so bogged down in this storyline that is like really not good.
You know, I disagree to a certain extent. I mean, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I do feel like the storyline is more convoluted than it needs to be, but also like really obvious. And I don't mind the obvious if the road that we get there, that takes us there, is a little less bumpy than this one is. You know, I don't know if your screening did this, but ours did. It started with David Leitch, the director, and Gosling talking about how they made this. They thought about the fans the entire time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one of those things. But this one I legitimately believe, because I think everything is just trying its goddamn hardest to please. And I think for the most part, I think it succeeds. I think there are certain things that don't. I think a lot of the action, a lot of the set pieces feel kind of episodic. Like there's a scene with Stephanie Hsu that like feels like it could just be yanked out of the movie and nothing would have changed.
Yeah, that's the kind of shit I'm talking about, because it all serves this other story. You know?
No, I get it. And I understand it. And if, you know, I think the vibe is, you know, and maybe I'm giving it too much credit, that it wanted to just, it's highlighting the stunts.
Right.
And that's, you know, could it have been integrated in a little more of a creative way? Yeah, 100%. I think that it gets by on the charisma of Ryan Gosling. And I do really like Emily Blunt. And I think Hannah Waddingham is fun. You don't think? I did not
like anything about that.
Really?
Or performance, yeah.
The one that rubbed me the wrong way was Aaron Taylor Johnson. I have a hard time with him. Like, it's really hit or miss with him for me. But
I mean, he goes for it. I'll give him
he
that.
He goes for it hard. But, you know, I don't think it resonates the way it should. And I don't know that it's his fault. But anyway, I mean, Gosling is the star here, the reason to see it. And I think for the most part, that's enough. You know, this is the kind of, crowd pleasing action comedy that would have been a hit, you know, like 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. That it kind of got not ignored at the box office, but you know, definitely underperformed, I think, is one of those things that people will call the death knell of adult movies, but, you know, then go look at something like Civil War that's succeeding. But
yeah.
Anyway, I enjoyed it for the most part. I think Gosling is the reason to see it, and he's probably the only real thing that's holding it together from being just a forgettable turd.
Yeah.
But I think it's enough. Personally, I think it's enough. But I understand where you're coming from to a certain extent. I do wish it were as clever as it thinks it is.
Well, it's that, but also, like, you can accomplish the goal of paying tribute to stunts and stunt performers while not bogging it down with this, like,
right,
not so interesting storyline. Like, you could have done anything, honestly,
yeah,
better than this. And I think too, like, again, even like on set conflict in a movie that highlights stunts, that piece of it is fine. I mean, I really do think that those scenes work better than anything else in the movie. And you can create the conflict between the characters while staying on set and stuff. But if you're going to send them outside of it, the storyline that they chose for it, I think, falls completely flat.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that maybe it's just the with what they were going for. I just thought of the other scene where Gosling breaks into what's his name? Aaron Taylor Johnson's apartment, his character in the movie, and he gets attacked. Like, yeah. I, you know, again, another scene that could be just lifted out and wouldn't make any difference to the movie. The thing that I really wish the movie would have touched on, and I think it would have added more humor to it, because there's a lot of humor in it, but I think it's a lot of it is really, this is going to sound negative, but it's forced and it's trying really hard. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea that a stuntman could be like an action hero, I think is one of the things that this movie is missing a reason for. Like, he's just like, there's, you know, it never really shows him like fake fighting. It shows him flipping a car and all this other shit. But like, you know, how would he become a badass? How would he be a badass? But
yeah.
Anyway,
that's right. Yeah.
What's your grade for The Fall Guy, Cody?
So I'm giving it a C+. I'm not going to recommend it. I think, again, for all the reasons I stated, I just think it's so heavily bogged down by this storyline. And again, it's not just the storyline itself. It's that it spends so much time in it that really is sort of the defeating thing. Because I do think that there is a version of this where the Gosling charm can get it over the finish line and make it enough. But I don't think that it's properly done to make it so in this the movie as it stands. So a C+ for me.
Yeah, I'm gonna give it a B. I liked it enough to recommend it on that level. I think it's fun. I don't think it's perfect by any means, but I think Gosling to me is enough to push it over. And I really did like Emily Blunt too. I think there's a better like real rom-com. Like an action rom-com?
Yeah, I think probably.
I think there's probably a better action rom-com in there than there is this action comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish like that would be closer to the version that we got. But anyway, I still think it's good enough for a B. All right, let's move on to our last movie, Unfrosted.
In the early 1960s, the American morning was defined by milk and cereal. And the two undisputed giants of the cereal world were Kellogg's and Post.
Major news from the breakfast world. The Post Cereal Company has reportedly invented a shelf-stable fruit pastry breakfast product.
No.
Yeah.
Boy.
It's Post! They did it!
I'm about to finally crush that big red K that never stops glaring at me!
How do you think Post did it?
There's always a surprise inside the box.
What if they use xanthan gum?
Xanthan.
Kellogg's is entering the race to reinvent breakfast with the help of Steve Schwinn, Chef Boyardee, and Jack LaLanne.
They're stacking the deck with ringers.
Hey, you know Isaiah Lamb from Quaker?
You Kellogg's people.
We're about to have some very powerful people very upset.
You have to win. Are you making any progress?
It's not to scale, but...
What are you guys, 5 years old? Little John draws better than that. And I think there's something wrong with him.
I just literally thought that I thought about this. I just watched the Ben Franklin episode of The Office.
Oh, yeah.
Andy Daly. How much Andy Daly looks the same in this movie.
Yeah.
So this is a Netflix film from director, co-writer, and star Jerry Seinfeld.
Yes.
So lots of stuff to talk about in this movie. Cody, tell us about it and what you thought of Unfrosted.
Sure. So the movie is I guess we'll call it a fictionalized, heightened version of the sort of creation of Pop-Tarts. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually know if there was like a Kellogg's and Post like similar products that came out around the same time or something like that, but the movie sort of immediately takes away any notion of this being an actual thing, an actual story, pretty early on involved. But and so you have these executives that work for Kellogg's who are played by, you know, like Jerry Seinfeld, Jim Gaffigan and Melissa McCarthy, and then the rival mm-hmm. Post is played by Amy Schumer plays Marjorie Post, and she has like Max Greenfield, who's like her you know, kind of like assistant
playing the Max Greenfield role.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so what you essentially get is this like exceedingly over the top sort of stitched together what kind of feels like sketch style comedy, where, you know, basically every actor that you ever see on screen is some kind of like comedic actor cameo, or sometimes not even comedic, but like every scene is a cameo from an actor that you recognize. It's I think Jerry Seinfeld called in every single favor he's ever had over, used his cachet for this. And yeah, I mean, it's, this movie is fascinating in how completely terrible. it's astonishing, right? So like, you know, interestingly, this is one of the few things that Jerry Seinfeld has done post Seinfeld. You know, after that ended, you know, he did B movie. Mm-hmm. He also did like Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, which is like a different thing altogether. And then he's done stand up, and that's basically the extent of his post Seinfeld career. And so to see him like at like 70 years old come out with this particular movie is just like, I want to study this. And like, it's you know, the humor style of it is like, it's like aggressively silly and kind of over the top. The jokes are filled with like the absolute lowest hanging fruit you could possibly have. Every single joke in this thing is easy. It's a layup. It's obvious.
I mean, it's what you would expect from a Seinfeld on his own, I think.
I think so. And I think what it does illustrate again is like maybe the power of Larry David and the success of Seinfeld as a TV show. But, you know, it's just like it is astonishingly unfunny for me personally. I saw someone say that it has the sort of like tone and energy of like a series of Super Bowl commercials. And I think that's maybe like the most accurate, you know, description of what this movie is. There's like, and it's got like, I wish I could credit the person who said that.
That's great.
But you know, you get these like over the top scenes where it's like, you know, like it, but it's in like, it's like the ridiculous shit. Like there's a mafia of milkmen that leads to this like cameo by Peter Dinklage. And then you have this like rivalry that happens back and forth with Post and Kellogg's. And then Kellogg's ends up researching by bringing in like Tom Carvel and Chef Boyardee. And I mean, it just feels like it feels like just like these series of like unfunny SNL sketches. Well,
yeah, that the whole like serial mafia or whatever. That's an SNL sketch. Oh, yeah. Milk. Sorry, not the
cereal funeral, which is one of the worst things I've ever seen.
I mean, that would have been that's a SNL sketch 100%. There is like one good line reading in there. From the character, one of the character's wives, mm-hmm. which is like it feels out of place. Like this thing isn't, I don't want to interrupt you, but it's so absurd.
Yeah.
It's like somebody watched like Late Night with Conan O'Brien in the 90s and just tried to remember like how to do that. Mm-hmm. Like just the weirdest shit like played straight.
Yeah.
Which I think it, I'm going to be fair. I think at some point it gets a real chuckle, like a real laugh.
Oh,
I can't remember anything.
I don't think I had an actual laugh the entire movie. Like,
I think
I'm just being like, that's totally honest.
And I think it might've come from Bobby Moynihan.
As Chef Moriarty.
Yeah. And I don't remember what. I feel like I had an authentic laugh in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah. Go ahead, you go ahead and finish your
and thoughts. Again, like you have performances for the cheap seats, like Jim Gaffigan is playing this so huge. Melissa McCarthy is being Melissa McCarthy. Seinfeld is being Seinfeld. Like there's no nuance in his performance.
Yeah,
you know, the rest is just like, you know, cameos. Like again, you have poor Hugh Grant, which I was reading his Wikipedia that he sent in an audition for the first time in 30 years for this role.
Oh my God.
He provided an audition tape for Seinfeld. you get, and I'll let you speak on the sort of big cameo of this one, is the exact embodiment of, I think, what they meant by a Super Bowl commercial. Cause that feels, yes. That scene feels like a Super Bowl commercial. I just don't know what to say, and it's weird because the movie looks slick, it's set
beautiful. It's like the set, like the production design is gorgeous.
Of the because it takes place in the 60s and it's got like a 60s look to it. I mean,
it's so solid in that respect.
Yeah, and clearly they spent money on it. Like clearly, mm-hmm. like this movie had a budget. I don't know what else to say about it other than like the cheap jokes it makes about like, and some of this stuff is like it, like you're like, they're making Kennedy jokes and they're making like Khrushchev jokes, like
Gus Grissom dying on the fucking launch pad jokes, like, dude.
Yeah, this, like, it's just a weird relic of I just don't, my biggest thing is like, I don't know who this movie is for. Like, this is a movie without an audience because it's not like smart enough to attract like highbrow comedy lovers. It's not like, I don't know that the old generation would find this funny because it's like exceedingly silly. I don't know that like silly comedy, like, fans would like it because it's like not, it doesn't have like any kind of bite. It's toothless, you know, in everything. And then also the silly nature is like, it's like the fruit is too low, you know, hanging too low for it. So I just like, it's just like fascinatingly terrible and like hard to watch terrible. And somehow, you know, you watch the first half of it and it's bad. And then it just gets worse because it all culminates in this sort of like January 6th,
I forgot about that. Fuck, I forgot about that.
where you have like literally Hugh Grant dressed as like the QAnon shaman.
Fuck, I forgot about that.
As part of it.
When you were talking about the ending, I was like, man, I don't fucking remember what happened.
Yeah.
And then you said the January 6th, I was like, oh shit.
Yeah. Dude, it's rough.
Yeah, I mean, all that you said and more. Look, I wasn't super into Seinfeld in the 90s at all. I definitely appreciate the accomplishment of it. like you said, it's very clear at this point that Larry David was the brains behind the funny there.
Yeah.
You know, with however many seasons we got in two decades of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And then kind of Jerry Seinfeld's just utter, like, cruise control to the max on this shit. Like, just doing the easiest stuff he could possibly do. And, I mean, I don't know if he got a good rug or what, but...
Oh, yeah.
That whatever he did with his hair is, I mean, like, he still looks pretty good for a 70-year-old dude.
Sure.
But anyway, I mean, this is, like, the epitome of what I would expect, like, going to a Seinfeld show. Like if I went to see Seinfeld at Caesar's Palace, I'm like, this is what I'm getting. Like, just, like, everybody that loves Seinfeld is like, yeah, Seinfeld. And then when you sit down and watch it, you're like, oh, man, I don't know if there's enough goodwill from Seinfeld to make this thing, like, palatable.
Yeah.
Because it's like, there are definite, like, Seinfeldish jokes in there. There's very, like, you know, like an episode of Seinfeld, it's very episode, very, you know, very, you know, kind of cuts from scene to scene. Like, it's real short scenes, right? Like, like very sketch like. It just, everything is so dire. And it, like, I appreciate the stab at just absurdity, but I think it's too much. Like, you could get away with one or two things. Like, it has to be relatively straight otherwise. But every scene is just dialed up to 11, and some of them just dripping with flop sweat. For what it's worth, I did read that the basic gist of the creation of Pop-Tarts is sort of what this mirrors. Obviously, the people and the scheming and the other stuff is fictionalized to the point of being, you know, a cartoon. But I'm kind of surprised that was the actual story, or close to it.
Yeah.
Like, just the basic, like, this one created this one, this one created this one. Though I will get to, like, the cameos are mostly, like, again, just layups. There's nobody that's, like, really challenging or that brings anything funny to it, or super funny to it. Then there's the last cameo, which is John Hamm and John Slattery essentially reprising their roles in Mad Men. Which, man, which also has a meta joke in it referencing the end of Mad Men.
Yeah.
It just, by the time that it gets to that point, I think I literally said, oh, fuck this. Like, not that I mean, Mad Men was a great show. I was a huge fan of it. I don't think that these characters, like, nothing besmirches the legacy of it in this movie, but it is, like, to the point of, like, this is not even funny. Like, and it's the scene is so long and full of, like, misunderstandings and just, I mean, it's just bad. It's just a bad fucking movie.
Yeah.
And I can see, like Netflix greenlighting this so it, you know, pops up every time somebody watches Seinfeld.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, watch this movie. Sure, and there's enough people.
And Seinfeld did a giant press run for this. Like,
oh, yeah. To the point where he was, you know, a bunch of shit he said outside of the context of the movie, like, probably soured a lot of people on him. Like, man, shut the fuck up. Like, old man. I mean, ironically,
I sent you privately something about that. And I actually kind of wasn't joking when I said,
I would believe that, I guess I won't say exactly what it was, but the gist of it was that, like, this movie takes place during a time when race relations were very poor, and there were racist, like, food mascots, and the speculation was he wanted to use one of those mascots and
That was the premise of what I was saying.
Right. So
I have no Hollywood insight information.
No, I mean, we're not claiming this, but it's a shockingly plausible explanation for why he felt the need to say what he said,
especially in the context of this movie, which has, like I said, no teeth. Like, this movie, like, and for Seinfeld to be the one talking about, like, PC culture, like, come on, you know?
Yeah, like, no one has he ever said anything challenging at all? Like, that's usually preceded by him or like immediately following saying something kind of racist.
No, but he says like certain parts, like certain storylines on Seinfeld wouldn't be able to be made today, which also is probably not true considering.
I mean, the only one I've ever
get away with a ton.
Yeah, the only thing I've ever heard even closely, something close to that, is that how many of their problems would have been solved with cell phones.
Oh.
Like, yeah. That's the legit one I've heard. But yeah, I mean, yeah, this is not offending anyone's sensibilities other than their sense of humor because it sucks so bad. Like, yeah. this movie is not... That was a good joke, right? That's a Seinfeld-level crack there. Yeah. The only people that are... I mean, like, this isn't, like, challenging as, like, a... You know, or trying to, like, re-embrace some sort of stereotype or whatever. Like, there's nothing offensive in this movie at all except that it just fucking blows.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure... You know, I mean, it's like a, everybody agreed to be in it because if Seinfeld's making this movie, let's go have some fun. Like, there's good performers in here that I think, you know,
sure.
I think acquit themselves pretty well. Like, I really like what Andy Daly's doing. I'm a sucker for Bobby Moynihan just because he goes big all the time and like big and silly. Poor Amy Schumer is stuck in here. I don't think she has much. I mean, again, Max Greenfield is doing Max Greenfield. Jim Gaffigan is swinging for the fences.
I'm looking at the cast here to see if I see anyone who I thought was like good.
I did enjoy Kyle Dunnigan.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Well, I mean, just because it's like he's doing a solid impression.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I think he's fine. Yeah,
Bill
Burr's
JFK.
I thought that was all right too. I mean, it just ends on like the worst joke, but
yeah.
Adrian Martinez as Tom Carvell was weird enough for me to be interested.
Did you like
just
Tom Lennon?
No, I did not. I love Tom Lennon, but I did not like him here. Let's see who else. I'm looking at this up. Dean Norris as Khrushchev was just sort of odd. In a different context, the Mikey Day, Kyle Mooney,
Drew Tarver,
those three as Snap, Crackle, and Pop could have been funnier in a different context, but I just don't think this is it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, what's your grade for Unfrosted, Cody?
Unfrosted is getting the gentleman's F. I'm going D- for Unfrosted. It should be a runaway Razzie winner for this year.
Yeah, I'm D minus for me too. If anybody remembers it, mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody will. It's so weird. Again, I was talking about this to somebody else. Like the press that Netflix gives some of these movies, mm-hmm. and the other ones that just appear there and also have huge stars in them that no one ever knew about. Mm-hmm. Like how they're, I don't know what its name is or anything, but there's a Kevin Hart, Mark Wahlberg movie.
Oh yeah,
on Netflix mm-hmm. that I had no idea existed. Like any of the Adam Sandler like not that they're probably any good, but it's just like, why are you not throwing these people out there? Like anyway, that's going to do it for this week.
Yeah.
Next week. I have no idea what's next week.
Yeah. I think we may end up taking it off just because the movies are like Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse movie, which apparently is super problematic. If the John Krasinski, Ryan Reynolds thing, and then The Strangers Chapter 1. So we may just gear up and wait for Furiosa and Garfield.
Yeah. Well, yeah. On that, I've been seeing so many ads for Strangers on social media, Strangers Chapter 1. Mm-hmm. Like they're really pushing it. Anyway, if you want to reach us, you can email us at podcast@cinesnob.net. Find us on Twitter @cinesnob, Facebook cinesnob.net, youtube.com/cinesnob. Anything else, Cody, before we go?
No, I think we're good.
All right, on that note, I'm Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody V. Fania.
Thank you for listening to the Cine Snob podcast. To read reviews, interviews, and more, visit cinesnob.net. See you next week.